You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Roy Shannon. I'm here on behalf of the appellants April Burke, Elizabeth Gibney, and Maria Cox. I'm joined by my colleagues Christina Brown, Kamala, and midterm right from the district. Your Honors, this case started out as an administrative process case. And as it proceeded, it's now turned into an administrative process case and a judicial process case. More importantly, with the judicial process, it deals with what should a circuit court judge consider on demur. And in this case, obviously, there was a motion-craving order that was filed by the defendants in this matter. And the two-prong, it's not even a two-prong, the first thing with order, the way the jurisprudence of this court has ruled in the past, is orders appropriate for letters of probate, administration, and in certain circumstances, deeds. In particular, when a deed has its intrinsic natural operation occur. That if you're filing a complaint based on a deed, then it needs to be the central aspect of the complaint. There was also a case, the Smith case, that included specialties. It's not clear where specialties came from because it wasn't in the Langhorne v. Richmond case, but those are contracts under seal. What's interesting is the recent jurisprudence at the circuit court level seems to indicate that contracts, written contracts, that are claimed for under breach of contract, that those should be attached. But I think one of the important things,
Counsel, may I ask you this? Those are fascinating questions, but are they not academic in this case?
How do you mean, sir? I don't think they are, because on a demur, the court should not have been considering 350 pages of multiple documents in a 5.5-hour hearing. They short-circuited the process by considering those things. I mean, this was an evidentiary issue. I think it's important when looking at the judge's comments from the bench, at least on the motion craving order.
Let me ask you, Counsel, just a second. Are you saying that you can never crave order of a document like this hearing, or in this case you shouldn't have been able to crave order?
I don't think order is appropriate for this. I think there is a level of documents or instruments, like as the ones the court has provided for, are of a higher dignity, that they are provided, you know, they have some effect after they're created. You know, a will has an estate document, it comes into effect when someone passes on and it operates after that. The same with certain deeds.
Well, for these hearings, this is all we have is these videotapes. Isn't that the trend? Isn't that where we're going with technology?
Well, if the court wanted to expand the document, and in particular documents for order, it could absolutely include a 5.5-hour video and 350 pages. I think the important thing here is most of the cases, the jurisprudence come down on order, it's by consent. So you have a consent, and really consent order is simply a Rule 1:8, leave to amend. Defendant says, can you attach it? Plaintiff says, sure, no problem.
So are we writing on a blank slate? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, I don't think there's a blank slate, because I think where there is opposition to an order, excluding the Culpepper case, I think most of the time the court has said it's not appropriate, that those are issues of evidence that come later. And especially, I mean, this was at demur. You know, so this was something that could have been contested and shown this testimony. And as the city will argue that this is a record, it's not the complete record. If you're looking at the legislative record, well, then you also have the city council hearing, the city council's second hearing where they had the first reading of the ordinance or the second ordinance, the reading of the second ordinance. Those hadn't occurred yet because we actually filed our declaratory judgment action before that time. So I don't think that order that you would expand it to this type of proceeding, because again,
so what relief are you asking the circuit court to issue? You want them to vacate the supermajority 6-1 vote?
Well, no. Right now, I mean, that wasn't in the record. What we're asking for is that the court declare that those two BZA appeals that were filed were deemed filed, therefore the stay should have been observed, and declaring the vote void. So yes.
Matter has been overtaken by events. Wasn't the point of the argument from the beginning that a supermajority was required for a text amendment? Well, there has been a supermajority.
Well, I think it's interesting. In the previous case that was before this court, I think it was overtaken by events. The city, we were able to get to the BZA after our third appeal, and we were successful there. But we ended up having to file a writ of mandamus. That ended up here. In the meantime, the city of Alexandria revoted 6-1. But that self-imposed voting restriction if we're going, you know, one question is whether or not that was even legal, whether a city manager or city council can self-impose a voting regulation. I don't know if that violates the Dillon rule at that point, but what if, I mean, you could see the political ramifications if local jurisdictions can, on a whim, require supermajority votes.
Well, a different way to ask it is, if the March 14th appeal had been accepted, and you had been successful, what would have been the result for your client?
Well, at that point, if we would have succeeded, if we were just able to be heard at the BZA, and that was successful, then possibly the processing of this, and that's, I think, what you're getting at, is what was the issue there, is at the time of filing that...
Well, no, if you had been successful, you would have gotten the supermajority vote.
Well, and it would have been processed as a map amendment. Right now, this was being
Which
processed.
Which means that you would...
Well, there's different procedures. The map amendment also has the requirement, the notice requirements are different. There's placards involved in that. It is a different process. So the BZA at that time, their ruling was that the previous text amendment and this text amendment, since I did identical, it's the same one, was in fact a map amendment. And that because it increased the height, density, and use and incorporated map, it was a map amendment. That was the ruling of the BZA. At the time that the...
Right, and then a result of that means that Section 11808 would have been triggered and you get a supermajority vote.
That's one of the sections that would have been triggered. There's other sections. The map and text amendment are processed differently and they have different requirements. In particular, it has a different notice requirement. The text amendment is just noticed by publication, whereas through the newspaper, map amendment, there's placards. So it's a different process. And so when we were asking, requesting these determinations and attempting to find out what was going on, we were completely stonewalled. And so we appealed to the BZA because their decision was basically being ignored at that point. And so we were seeking to have that information, to have the BZA rule on that issue, that it should have been processed as a map amendment. Because, again, I don't think that the city council has the ability to self-impose a voting restriction on itself the way it did. I believe that while there's no direct case law on point, and that wasn't really the issue here, but I don't think that they have the authority. I think they have to pass an ordinance to say we're going to vote on these issues by supermajority so that ordinance can be overturned. But I don't think that they have the ability to do that. I think the city charter really lays out specific areas where you can have supermajority voting requirements, whether it's taxation, the financial aspect, or in this case, when you have a map amendment that's being processed. But one could see that if this was to go that route, let's say it was, and again, the 6-1 was not in the original pleading. I wasn't before the court. But if this was to play out, who's to say on a 5-2 vote, if it was 5-2, that a landowner in that zone couldn't sue the city and say that was an illegal vote. That should never have occurred. And if it should have never have occurred, well, the 5-2 would have been successful instead of being denied. So I don't think the city could have done that. But I think part of the greater concern for us is under 917, the General Assembly gave the citizens of Alexandria a right to be heard by the Citizen Oversight Board, the BZA. And we have a statutory right to a hearing. We shall be heard. And we were deprived that right. And part of the whole process of 917 is that they initiate a stay of all further proceedings. That stops so this could be resolved by the BZA. Once the BZA makes its ruling on this about how this should be processed, among other things, then at that point, someone can appeal it to the circuit court, or even at that point, the city can proceed. The city has not been harmed by this process or any of those property owners. At any point, they could go for their own, the property owners could have gone for their own individual map amendment. But the appellants in this matter have been, because they haven't been able to be heard. And the second appeal, the March 15th, we appealed her rejection. She rejected and said, we challenge, you don't have that authority.
Couldn't they have been heard at the city council meeting?
The individuals could have been heard, but they're not the ones that are specialized in zoning, like the Board of Zoning Appeals that hears this, who had a pending ruling that was still good law.
Whether it was a text amendment or a map amendment, right?
Right.
Right.
They can absolutely, the public hearing, the city council is one avenue to be heard, but the BZA can actually make rulings. And their last ruling was, we feel, was being disregarded.
Who do you contend makes the determination about whether an appeal should be heard or not? Aren't there some appeals that would be so frivolous that they should just be dismissed outright, or do you disagree with that?
Well, it's interesting. If you want to draw the distinction between administrative requirements, if the filing fee was provided, the $350, that was provided. We received a receipt. We had the number of copies. But issues like whether it's aggrieved or determination or standing, those are substantive matters that should be decided by the BZA. They've done it in the past. I mean, otherwise, the city gets the form shop anytime it wants to shut us out of the administrative process. And 917 says we shall be heard. It's an aggrieved person, files it with the director and the board. And I think it's important that the variance and special exception, other matters that the BZA hears, are legislative in nature, and they are processed differently. However, an appeal is the only one that's filed both with the director and the board. This was done both. We filed with the director and during the convened session of the BZA, as well as emailing, too. At this point, the director can, if it stands today, the director can reject any appeal. In terms of the frivolous nature of it,
let's say there was an appeal that said you can't have a decision when the moon is full. That's the basis of the appeal.
Right. And I think at that point, even now, there's nothing preventing the BZA for setting up rules like other jurisdictions have about what is deemed a determination to be appealed, you know, or what can be appealed. Because you're absolutely right. Someone could just say, I appeal this. But the court, or the BZA, which is like the court in this situation, can go ahead and set up rules that say this is how it occurs. I know from the jurisdiction of Fairfax, when the director, if they reject an appeal, the chairman can override it immediately. We don't have that here. So the BCA has the rulemaking authority.
So it's not in the statute at all. It's not in the language at all.
Well, no. And 917 just says you file it with both, and you shall be heard. At that point, the only...
You don't want us to write legislation, do you?
What? I don't want this court to do it. But in interpreting 917, if the appeal is filed, then there it is. Now, if they want to say that there's a checklist that has to occur that the clerk, the director in this case, can do, then the clerk can go ahead and check off fee paid, a number of copies. Those are administrative in nature. Whether or not they're agreed, and here's the difference, is the clerk in this case is the person we're challenging. She's her own gatekeeper. I mean, to me, that's the...
What exactly was the basis of the March 14 BZA appeal?
The basis of the appeal is that the director... They were treating it as a text amendment. In fact, it was a map amendment. From the previous ruling of the BZA, it was a map amendment, and it should have been processed differently. It would have been entitled to the supermajority vote, a proper supermajority vote, and moreover, the notice requirements would have been different. A map amendment and text amendment are treated differently. So a map amendment, there's notice by placard and things of that nature.
What was the actual determination, and when was it made, that you say was adverse to your clients and which you had a right to appeal on the March 14 BZA appeal?
The director's, in her staff report and recommendation that she presented and her staff presented on March 5th, she processed it as and said this was a text amendment. In fact, it was not. We were challenging the determination that this was a text amendment. We considered it a map amendment. The BZA considered a map amendment. Her determination to her decision, because the code 917 or the charter 917 says it is to be processed any decision.
How did she make that determination? I thought all she said, this is the docket, and we're calling it a text amendment on the docket.
No, her staff report lays out this is being processed as a text amendment. She gave the history of the BCA's process, and she forwarded it as such. But there was a brief 3 minutes in the beginning before her staff took over where she said we're processing this as a text amendment, and we're self-imposing a supermajority vote, which, again, I don't think they have the authority to do.
And this is all on the videotape.
But this is not the videotape. And the staff report. However, the staff report we argue doesn't actually become the staff report that's presented to council because it could be amended up to the point of the Planning Commission hearing. But if I may...
Let me ask you a question, if I might. I tend to agree with your argument that the director, under these circumstances, should not be the one who decides the merits of your notice of appeal. And under these circumstances, the Board of Zoning Appeals is where that should have been. But having said that, I'm still trying to figure out how your clients were aggrieved. Wait just 1 second. You wanted a supermajority vote. You got that one. There are notice requirements that are different between the text amendment and the map amendment. But these plaintiffs clearly had notice. So if they had notice, they're not aggrieved. And if you got the supermajority vote that you wanted, you've gotten exactly what you wanted. Tell me how you were aggrieved.
With purposes, and I'd like to read a little bit of time for our rebuttal, but we are agreed to the extent that it was RBZ appeal that was currently pending, that that was the rule that they were ignoring and avoiding. And the public process is very important to where we should be allowed, not just us, but there are other people, but it was our appeal, the April 12th decision that was pending. Can I remain in mouth for rebuttal, please?
You got 1 second.
Well, and as Clerk would say, since you only have 1 second, I have a question I want to ask you. And so you're going to actually get a little bit more in 1 second, but it won't be a rebuttal. Was Oyer Crave concerning the amended complaint?
No, it was not. The Oyer was considered for the purposes of the second amended complaint as well.
And it doesn't seem to be anything in the record that indicates that the court considered the document that was provided as a result of Craven Warrior in deciding the Second Amendment complaint should be, the demur should be granted on the Second Amendment complaint, correct?
Well, I think that it was because they determined that it did not make a decision or determination, that they considered that. And I think if you look at the first.
So why couldn't they have done that as a matter of law, based on what you said? Because in your complaint, you basically just said that the person called a map amendment, a text amendment, a map amendment.
Because the court did consider that in the first demur hearing, and I think it's the inference that where he said, and this is on Joint Appendix 2010 or 210 lines 11 through 21, I just can't find from the face of the pleadings that as a threshold matter the director said anything except to refer to the amendment as a text amendment, and that was constitutes a determination or perhaps more. So the court considered it clearly on the first.
But they said on the face of the document, on the face of the complaint.
Well, and it's that she said anything. And I think it's also important, on that Oyer, to that point, in the Joint Appendix 106, lines 9 to 16, the comment that the court made, that reading the pleading and listening to you all and all considering the case to decide. And the court was granting an evidentiary hearing at demur.
But you're talking about the demur on the original complaint.
Well, actually, that was during the motion craving order when he
right. So that had to do with the original complaint, not the amended complaint.
That's right. And but our position would be that if they granted Oyer, and that was considered forward, that was the first domino that set this into action, that the court shouldn't have considered that on demur. I mean, we ask that this case be remanded back down, having Oyer being denied, and that from that point the city can demur at that stage.
All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is John Wilburn. I'm with McGuire Woods, and I represent the city of Alexandria in this matter. We ask that the court affirm the circuit court's decision dismissing the complaint with prejudice. As an initial matter, I think it's helpful to point out the application of Rule 5:11 to the appeal, and some of the questions that the court has had of the appellants are the exact questions that the trial court had of the then plaintiffs when this matter was argued on demur. The difficulty, I think, and perhaps the unfairness towards the trial court is that there's no transcript or no statement of facts for this body to consider in the same way that the trial court was able to consider the argument below. It's clear from the final order in the joint appendix that the trial court did, in fact, rely upon argument. The final order says that the court's decision is based upon the pleadings filed by the parties, the motion before the court, which was the demur and the opposition thereto, and the argument of counsel.
May I interrupt you there and follow up with a clarification that Justice Goodwin asked? The sequencing is the decision that we're reviewing is the granting of the demur to the Second Amendment claim. The general principle is that with successive demurs, you have to replead the earlier pleading that was rejected, and you have to essentially reprocess the case anew. And if you want to preserve for appeal, you've got to replead all of the rejected things and the ultimate affirmative pleading that's rejected. But as Justice Goodwin's question points out, it appears that the Second Amended complaint withdrew the specific language that referred back to obliquely to the director's recommendation and just summarily said there was a decision at some point. So am I understanding the case correctly? So all this trial judge did is say to him or herself, Well, what decision? And how did it affect anybody? And what violation of law was it? And you didn't plead it on the face of the pleadings. It's not specific enough for anybody to make a reasoned decision. So I grant the demur. So am I right or wrong that the academic debate about craving Oyer with the original pleadings is not really before us?
I think you're right that it's an academic debate. I think it's an interesting one. It wasn't the basis for the trial court's decision. The trial court ordered in response to the first demur that the plaintiffs do what plaintiffs are obligated to do, which is to plead facts in support of their claim. The specific facts that they needed to plead and the trial court ordered that they plead is the determination. What is the determination form the basis of the appeal, and how are you aggrieved? And some of the questions about injury and whether the plaintiffs and now appellants are aggrieved, but the court's asking the same questions that the trial court asked. So the case wasn't decided based on Oyer at all. It was decided based on a failure to plead after the plaintiffs had given an opportunity to specifically plead the determination and the injury. And all the trial court had before it at that point was the attachment to the amended complaint, which was the appeal. And the appeal said very vaguely that they were appealing the director's determination relating to Text Amendment 2013-05 and Text Amendment 2013-06 that she provided the Planning Commission's March 5, 2013 meeting. So the trial court asked for, required, and I think at the argument on the second demur struggled to obtain from the then
because
plaintiff.
The trial judge didn't know, and we would not know if we hadn't this gigantic file, what that determination was.
We don't. I don't think we know even as of today. We don't know. And that's really the fundamental issue I think that the trial court had is it enough for a landowner simply tender a paper to the director and say, based on my tender of this paper to your office, all of the process in the city council stops?
My question is not so much that. My question is a trial judge. When a trial judge gets a deck action or a complaint that's challenging this, as I read this trial judge, the trial judge is saying, you need to tell me what the determination was that you want me to hear. But if you just tell me a determination was made on a subject matter generally, that's even under notice pleading, that's not enough.
That's correct. And I don't think it was an oversight. I believe the appellant's position then and now is that the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to determine whether there was a determination made or whether the appellants were aggrieved that it wasn't within the trial court's purview. And so they didn't need to plead it, and they made the conscious decision to not plead it. I think that's wrong. The plaintiffs, the appellants now, invoke the jurisdiction of the court. They filed a declaratory judgment action, and a basic concept of jurisprudence is that you have to demonstrate a real case or controversy in which you're aggrieved. And having invoked the jurisdiction of the court, they were obligated to plead a cause of action that entitled them to relief, and they declined to do that.
Let me ask you a question, if I might. The City Charter 917 and the Zoning Ordinance 11-1203 work together fairly seamlessly. It starts with the person aggrieved is the first issue. You have to be aggrieved in order to be able to take advantage of these appellate processes. The trial judge felt if you're not aggrieved at that stage, you're certainly not going to be heard on a declaratory judgment action. And that was one of the reasons why the demur was sustained. So if you look at it, I'll come back to aggrieved in a moment, but if you look at the ordinance itself, it says that in where it is alleged there is an error from any order, requirement, decision, or determination, that then the director receives that appeal, and then it says, the director shall forthwith forward to the board all the papers constituting the record upon which the action appealed from was taken. It doesn't say that the director is supposed to decide whether this is a meritorious appeal. It says they're supposed to forward it on to the Board of Zoning Appeals because it's alleged. And it is, in fact, alleged that the error is from a decision or determination made by the director. So on the face of this, it would appear to me that the director has no authority to make the decision not to take that appeal and pass it on to the board. That's my view of the case. There's six other justices here.
It's snowing.
But my dilemma is that I still haven't heard how these people are aggrieved. Will you address it?
Yes. The appellants are not aggrieved. We've been before this is the second time that an appeal's been taken to this court, and part of the joint appendix is this court's previous opinion dismissing the previous appeal for mootness, and it resulted from that second vote. The fundamental complaint here is that the appellants believe they were entitled to the process associated with a map amendment instead of a text amendment. They got that process. We litigated for close to 2 years, including up to this court, over that issue. And ultimately, rather than continue on with the trial, the city threw up its hands and said, we will revote the entire amendment, and we'll do it with a supermajority requirement consistent with a map amendment. That vote took place. It was a 6-1 supermajority decision, and it's now final. This isn't about an actual pecuniary or property rights deprivation that these appellants have suffered, which is the standard for being aggrieved. This is about the appellants not wanting the vote to take place at all.
Okay, Council, let me. I'm sorry.
They could have been aggrieved by not being able to participate, but they did participate and they had notice. So that's out of the question as well.
And here's my follow-up question. They are saying they're aggrieved because if there was more notice given, other people would have shown up at the hearing. Is that the kind of way somebody can be aggrieved?
I think in a theoretical sense, but what this body has held repeatedly is you can't establish the element of being aggrieved on a speculative or theoretical basis. It has to be grounded in concrete facts. And if you look at either the original complaint or the amended complaint, which we're reviewing for the purposes of appeal, they don't allege any of those things. Those facts that there is some specific individual, or for these individuals who are the individuals who brought the lawsuit, were deprived of either notice or opportunity to be heard. And I think, and they don't even allege that there's some group of people that's unidentified in our parties that were deprived of an opportunity to be heard. But if they did that, those individuals aren't before the court and would be speculative. But it really goes back to the pleading problem, which is they haven't alleged in the amended complaint any way in which they were aggrieved other than the fact that the vote took place that they didn't want to occur. And that's not enough under this body's jurisprudence.
Let me ask this. They made it in their argument, they talked about there being different notice requirements if it were a map amendment as opposed to a text amendment. What do you have to say about that?
Well, two things. One, that's not an issue that was alleged in the amended complaint or argued before the circuit court judge. But the second thing, this was processed with notice as a map amendment. I believe that to be the case. It's not something that was litigated at the circuit court level. And there's no allegation that any individual suffered a lack of notice. So if there was a notice variance, and I don't believe that there was, but I guess I could be wrong on that, they haven't identified any individual in their amended complaint that suffered a lack of notice or lacked an opportunity to participate in the process in any way whatsoever. So it would be, if there was an issue, it would not be as to these plaintiffs, and it would be speculative that something like that actually occurred.
And it wasn't pled, is what your real argument is, right?
And it wasn't pled, but even if you had pled that, the problem is these appellants did participate, and you would be asserting a speculative right of some third party who may or may not have had notice. And that's not something that the circuit court was obligated, if they had pleaded it, to give any weight to.
Plus, that third party could have spoken for or against the amendment. Who knows?
That takes you down the rabbit hole of speculation, and it certainly is a basis, I believe, to reverse the trial court's decision.
Let me just throw this out there for you to take a look at. Pull out the amended complaint. It's in the appendix, page 223. It's where I want to take you to, paragraph 26.
Like what you say, 223?
Yes, of the appendix.
Paragraph 26?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It seems to me there they talk, they're stating a specific determination. They have a problem with, don't they? The director's determination, decision to process and classify text amendment 2013-2005-0005 as a text amendment as opposed to a map amendment. Isn't that what there's?
Well, that's their characterization of what occurred during the March 5 hearing.
Right.
But what the court was looking at, that's the allegation that the court is entitled to look at when there's an allegation and attached to the complaint is an exhibit, and the exhibit is either inconsistent with the allegation, you look at the exhibit.
What's the exhibit inconsistent with that?
Well, the exhibit is at Joint Appendix 255, and it's the actual appeal application to the Board of Zoning Appeals. And I read this language earlier, but the requirement in the application is that the appellant identify the order, requirement, or decision for determination that is the subject of the appeal, and to attach a copy to the application. And this is not a this is not a meaningless requirement. I want to go back to the Chief Justice's question about 11-1203 and how appeals are taken. When a person who is aggrieved tenders an appeal, you don't automatically have a right to appeal. There's some requirements that have to be met. You have to be a citizen of the city. You have to pay the filing fee of the appropriate copies. But you also have to specify the grounds of the appeal. That's in 11-1203. And the purpose of that, there's a purpose, is the director shall forthwith forward to the board all the papers constituting the record upon which the action appealed from was taken. And so there's a specific purpose here, which is to...
Isn't that Part B supplement? Isn't that what...
Well, there's a Part B supplement. I can talk about that. Part B supplement takes you back to the litigation that occurred previously between the parties that was taken up. And the Part B supplement also refers the court to the five-hour transcript that they complain about. But the point here is to allow the director to understand what the determination was so that he or she can take the record, and there's usually a record associated with that determination. There's a written determination that has a notice under the 15.2-2203 that says this is a determination, your rights are affected, you have a right of appeal, and then behind that there's typically a written record, and that all goes to the Board of Zoning Appeals.
Can I just take you to the point?
Yes.
Why don't you take us here? I mean, what are you saying? Are you saying this isn't specific enough? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it's not specific enough, but I'm also saying that it's certainly not as specific as what they've attached to the complaint, where they specifically pointed to the grounds for the appeal being a statement that is contained somewhere in that March 5 hearing. And that's what I think the trial court struggled with. In order to determine whether you're aggrieved and whether there's a determination, which is the threshold on whether there's an appeal, the trial court wanted to know what's the determination, point you to the determination, and explain how you're aggrieved. And
isn't there argument? We said in paragraph 26, the determination was that this was a text amendment. And then they pointed to the introduction by the Mr. Hamner telling the Planning Commission what happened. And he says, we're presenting a text amendment. And so what I understand their argument to be is that they wanted the board to determine whether that statement was a determination. And so the allegation is there, and the statement is in the record.
What the board would do is determine the merits of the appeal. Mm-hmm. And in order to have an appeal, you have to have both a determination and be aggrieved.
And I don't quibble with Justice Lemon's position on aggrieved, but they're saying the decision was that this is a text amendment, and that by calling it a text amendment, that was a determination, and we wanted the board to determine that it was.
I understand. It's a close call on that issue. I believe the trial judge had it correct that this was not a determination. I understand the appellant's argument on that point. But the process that the trial court looked at, and is the trial court found this to be insufficient and wanted to know specifically what the determination was and asked them to plead it, found this to be inadequate for that purpose. And the second part was whether or not they'd been aggrieved. And I think that second part really is, if there's error on this issue, and we'd suggest that there's not error, it would be harmless error, because these are appellants who have suffered no injury of any type other than the opportunity to stop the vote. But the vote went the way, if it was in fact a map amendment as opposed to a text amendment in the way that they wanted it to be determined, they would have been entitled to a supermajority vote, which is what in fact happened.
All right, your time has expired. Call the next case.
Thank you.